Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The National Rifle Association is a big supporter of President Trump. Just this week, its top executive, Wayne LaPierre, had the president's ear over gun background checks in the United States. And historically, the organization has had huge gun lobbying powers and presence in Washington. But there's turmoil inside of the NRA. More board members resigned this week, and now the New York Times reports that the NRA's longtime outside legal counsel has split from the group. We wanted to get some insights on how members are feeling about all of these changes, as well as the direction of the NRA. We have with us Rob Pincus. He's a 30-year member and also a spokesperson for Save the Second, a pro-guns rights group that is pushing for reform inside of the NRA. And he's in Silverton, Colorado. Rob, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya. It's definitely a interesting time inside of the firearms community, and we need a strong NRA, and that's what Save the Second is working for.
Well, let's get right to it. You've been a 30-year member. You're now a life member. You believe in the NRA mission, but do you feel like the organization has lost its way?
Absolutely. At least the leadership has lost its touch with the American gunner, the average NRA member. You know, I've been a member off and on. I've supported the mission of the NRA and the idea of the NRA for as long as I can remember. And I've become much more active, particularly in the last few months, trying to help the NRA get back on track.
And what is the mission of the NRA? Just to express that, where would you like to see the leadership take the organization?
Well, and I think the news even being reported this week that President Trump is speaking with Wayne LaPierre and that Wayne LaPierre is referencing the mission of protecting the Second Amendment and protecting our gun rights, defending our gun rights. In some ways, we have to regain some of our lost gun rights in this country. Unfortunately, the more frequent messaging that we've been getting from the NRA, and certainly the dysfunction in the way that they're handling the money that members are and other donors are providing to the NRA for that mission, those are the real problems.
And when you talk about the financial situation, you're talking about reports that Wayne LaPierre has been accused of financial mismanagement and those types of things?
Absolutely. And it's not just the personal thing. You know, a lot of this certainly been his watch and his leadership that these problems have developed under. But there are bigger problems in terms of contracting and cronyism, you know, a very much a good old boy system that has existed at the top of the NRA and at the top of the firearms industry for a long time. And whether or not Wayne created that, he certainly has overseen quite a bit of questionable financial dealings.
Well, how has this infighting weakened the influence you feel of the group on these gun rights efforts?
Well, the concern is that the NRA won't be taken seriously by lawmakers or even potentially in the White House as things continue to unravel there. So while they may still be able to spend money lobbying and money supporting campaigns of people that are aligned with American gun owners, if they can't compel American voters, the gun owners themselves, to do what we believe is in the best interest of gun rights because we're concerned about the way the NRA is doing business, then obviously that affects their influence. The good news is the American gun owner is its own voting bloc, much larger than the NRA represents.
Let's talk a little bit about messaging. One big criticism about the NRA is that collectively it gives the message that it cares more about gun rights than people's lives and finding common ground to end gun violence. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I think one of the major problems with that piece of the messaging is the failure to acknowledge negative outcomes, right? There are negative outcomes that accompany gun ownership and the presence of guns in the United States. What we need to be thinking about is how to mitigate those negative outcomes through responsibility, through the enforcement of existing laws, and through other measures that don't infringe further upon the rights of the law-abiding American gunner, the person who hasn't done anything wrong, the person who hasn't shown any proclivity to do anything wrong, the person who hasn't been adjudicated, you know, a danger to themselves or others because of mental issues. And I think that's why the NRA gets a bad rap, is they don't talk a lot about what we do, and we do a lot inside of the firearms community to avoid those negative outcomes, but they don't talk a lot about it, and that makes them potentially seem callous at times.
What do you want to see immediately happen within the organization to turn what you feel like is a ship around that's going the wrong way?
I think it's obviously time for Wayne and some of the other ingrained old guard to move on. Let the NRA start the process of healing, start the process of fixing its image inside and outside of the community. I think obviously, is as I said earlier, it's not just one person. Something like the change with the NRA TV going away, which was had turned into a mouthpiece for conservatism and only representing sort of a small niche of gun owners. That change is a good change. Mm-hmm. A change in leadership would be a good change, and a change in the structure and systems at the board to get the board more involved so that we don't have board members resigning because they feel powerless. Those things would all be very positive.
Rob Pincus is a lifelong member of the NRA and a spokesperson for Save the Second, a pro-gun rights group that is pushing for reform inside of the NRA. Rob, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Tanya.
And we reached out to the NRA for comment, and we're waiting for a response.
And let's take a look at how the week's news is filtering through social media. Femi Ok is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, it's Friday. Good to have you back.
Good to be back. Hello, Peter.
Okay, so let's take a minute to note the death of David Koch today. He and his brother are the billionaire philanthropists who've had incredible sway over the years over the Republican Party. Many conservatives see him as a hero. Many liberals revile him, and that dichotomy was apparent on social media today, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Trending on social right now. So some of the words I was looking for, the phrases I was looking for, billionaire David Koch and RIP David Koch, all of those are the trending phrases. I'm looking for admirers versus the critics. I'm finding more critics than admirers. Let me give you a couple of admirers here. Senator Rand Paul, RIP to a man who lived a life of liberty, peace, and philanthropy. Great blessings bring great responsibility.
From one libertarian to another,
lived that way. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's the context of that. But what I'm seeing much more of, and I've looked through hundreds and hundreds of comments, this one here from the Cato Institute. Matthew Feeney picks up this quite nicely. He describes it. He describes the gleeful goals taking pleasure in his death. That would be David Koch's death. He said that they should consider the fact that he outdid them all when it came to his commitment to freedom and peace. I would like to share with you some of the critics, but some of them are very difficult to actually repeat on the radio. So I'm going to go to Joe Spudzer. He's a Canadian, so he's got a little bit more distance here. Okay, so he describes the situation that's happening online right now. The right and the left in US politics having very different reactions to the passing of hashtag David Koch. Go look for it yourself, then you can curate what you want to see, what you don't want to see. But safe to say, as far as Google Trends are concerned, they watch what we are all searching. He is the top search right now.
Say what you want about the man's politics, but boy, people are being mean on Twitter over this.
If you know him or if you liked him, if you're family of his, just stay offline for a little while.
Yeah. All right. On to the Amazon fires. They're raging through the rainforest in Brazil. We've been covering that story. We've also noticed the hashtag Pray for the Amazon is trending this week. What are you seeing?
I've been seeing weeks and weeks of concern online about the Amazon rainforest and maybe not getting as much coverage as it deserves. I know Here and Now has done that, as you have said. Matt Haig says a little letter to the media. He says, remember when you had the Notre Dame fire on every front page? It would be nice if you also placed the current unprecedented fires destroying the Amazon rainforest, as not only do people and animals live there, but we also need it to breathe. Online, some really interesting memes and pictures happening. And for me, that gives me hope that the message is getting out there and that it's becoming more public and more tabloid as of the people. So people are doing things like their house and then the house is on fire. And then they're saying, we really need to save Amazon because that's where I get all of my goods. Huh. It's a little facetious, but it really brings the whole point home very quickly for people who may not be following the environmental story.
What about these fake photos or misleading photos that are cropping up online related to these fires?
Oh, Peter, and this happens a lot when we're talking about natural disasters because usually the visuals are extraordinary. And of course, the same goes here for the wildfires in the Amazon. But people are finding pictures that may be old pictures, not from this year, pictures from 30 years ago. Best way to avoid doing that, from best way from retweeting old pictures or making a mistake is either look for NOAA or look for NASA. The pictures they have will be up to date and relevant, and then you won't embarrass yourself.
Okay. Well, ABC's hit show Dancing with the Stars. Yes, we're going to talk about this.
Talking about embarrassing.
Is about to get a lot spicier, pardon the pun there, this week.
Yes.
It was announced that the former White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, will be a cast member for the upcoming season. Here he is on Fox and Friends.
It's the kind of entertainment that I could actually encourage my kids and family to watch.
Right.
It's what we need more of, which is good, wholesome entertainment. And I get way out of my comfort zone and do something that's totally new to me.
So Sean Spicer is very happy about this, but boy, oh boy, others are not.
Oh, goodness me. People who are happy about this, Sean Spicer and perhaps the producers at Dancing with the Stars, people are very unhappy. Oh, lots of people on social. Lady Star Gem says, shame on you, ABC Network. Shame on you, Dancing ABC. Shame on you. Why all this shame? Well, because people are saying online that you shouldn't get to rehabilitate your reputation if you have a controversial reputation. You shouldn't be able to go on and do the cha-cha and then wipe it all out. So that is the debate. And even the host of the show said that, and he tweeted out that he asked the producers not to go political. Let's to make it a family fun competition. And they decided that they weren't going to listen to him.
Shame on you is a favorite refrain on Twitter these days. I have just been noticing. Femi Ok, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome, Peter. Take care.
The yield curve has inverted. In the past, this has been an indicator that a recession is on its way. But will this time be different? Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money, NPR's daily economics podcast, to find out.
Shirley Chisholm shattered the glass ceiling in 1968 when she became the first black woman elected to Congress. Chisholm famously said, "If they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair." It turns out, decades later, that's still easier said than done for many women of color. It's why our next guest wrote a how-to book of sorts. It's called The Memo, What Women of Color Need to Know to Secure a Seat at the Table. Minda Hartz, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Sonia. Happy to be here.
So at the beginning of your book, you give the reasoning for why you wrote this book specifically for women of color. You say, like many women, like myself, you went out and bought Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, which, for those who don't know, is kind of the holy grail for women's empowerment and how to get a seat at the table. But when you were done, you were disappointed. What was missing for you?
Yeah, I was disappointed because so many women, I put that in quotations, were excited about this book. But I didn't see myself as a black woman or a woman of color in the book. I felt that it's hard to lean in when you're not even in the room. And I don't think you address some of those issues that some of us face. Everyone doesn't experience the workplace the same.
And what are some of those issues?
One of the issues that I felt was missing was race. I think it's hard to talk about a seat at the table when you don't acknowledge that not all ceilings are created equal. We have the wage gap for black and brown women is much different than Caucasian women. And I think that, you know, Sheryl wrote from a place of privilege. Now, I don't take it away that that is her story. That is what she drew from. But I think that there are many nuances to the table. And I felt like it was time for black and brown women to finally be able to shake their head up and down and read some of the common themes that we experience when we try to lean in.
In talking a little bit about that disparity, you mentioned leadership roles in Fortune 500 companies and board positions specifically. 28% of women hold board positions for Fortune 500 companies, but that number is much lower in the single digits for black and brown women. You also talk a bit about the labels and the stereotypes and how they come into play when you are in corporate situations. So, for instance, the angry black woman, the feisty Latina, the docile Asian, and how that comes into play in your interactions when you're dealing with coworkers and colleagues. Do you have a specific story that stands out for you?
One of the women that I spoke with while writing the book, she told me that her white male boss could never remember her name and made her wear a name tag. And she was there for 7 years. And when she went to speak on about it, they told her, don't be the angry black woman. And it's like, well, how are you supposed to feel working somewhere for 7 years and you're always getting my name wrong? You know, so it's things like that, that we don't even have the agency to speak out on at times.
You often talk a lot in the book about microaggressions. I once had a boss who kept calling me Detroit Tanya. That's where I'm from originally. But he kept saying, I want to see Detroit Tanya, not this polished Tanya that I see. And I sort of felt that that was a microaggression of sorts, because what he was seeing is actually Tanya. And you had a story similar to that with the nail polish thing when you were working in corporate America and someone mentioned the colors that you were wearing.
Yes, absolutely. Microaggressions and bias are real. And when I was in corporate America, my manager commented on my nail color, which at the time it was summertime. And so I had on the color burnt orange. And he said, you people love your bright colors. And he joked with another white male colleague for about 15 minutes about how black people like bright colors.
Yeah. The numbers, the statistics are out there on the percentages of women who are in leadership positions. And in talking about the wage disparity, black women in the United States on average are paid about 61 cents for every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men. This book, though, is a how-to book on ways that women can get a seat to the table. So let's start talking a little bit about your tips. You say that, number one, you should build your squad both internally and externally. Talk a little bit about what that is and why that's important.
Yes, we talk a lot about networking. I think it's so important and crucial for women of color if we want the seat at the table. And I realize not everybody wants that. And that's okay, too. And so figuring out, do you want to secure your seat? And that will require you to build what some may see as allyship, build relationships with key stakeholders in the organization and your colleagues that you work with side by side, but having people who can speak on your behalf when you're not in the room. And for me in particular, it was building that squad, that team inside the workplace that helped me secure my seat at the table.
Mm. And you also talk about really getting to know your colleagues and your coworkers. It's something that we often think, okay, you're playing a game, but this game is important because you find your other colleagues are also doing this.
Absolutely. You know, I hate that the game is still in motion, right? This like imaginary game of life that we're all playing inside the workplace, but there are some things to do and navigate to get that seat, and then we can bring others along with us so that we don't have to experience the isolation. But I found when I built my squad inside the workplace that I had many more opportunities to thrive and not just survive.
Yeah, and building your team and also playing that game. That means after work, taking the time to go out for drinks or for golf, as we always use that as an example. Getting to know your coworkers and colleagues in their personal lives and opening yourself up to allow them to get to know you as well.
Yes, because I think, at least for me, when I entered the workplace, we were told, just do your job and put your head down, right? So we didn't go to the after work activities. We didn't maybe go to the break room when the birthdays were happening. And I think two things happen. People get to see us in a different way, but then we also get to observe those who could be potential squad members, because not everybody at work is your friend and wants to see you win. And so you may not always know that about them, just passing them casually on the way to get coffee.
What are some other ways that white allies within the workplace can help, can be a part of producing that culture? Maybe they are not even in leadership positions, but they may be your coworkers and your colleagues.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I talk about was an experience that I was going through of being one of the only black women in the workplace. And when the situation was happening, the situation caused for me to be an advocate for myself, but then my white coworkers just watched it all go down, and in secrecy, they would come and see if I was okay and say, sorry, you're going through this. But when they had the opportunities to speak up about it in public, they did not stand up for me. And I think that if you're a colleague of any color or gender, I think it's important to be there in public and also educating yourself and using books like The Memo to see what you've been doing, how have you been contributing to some of the discomfort that women of color have been experiencing in the workplace? And I think it requires that education piece to truly be an ally.
In combating all of this with imposter syndrome, we hear a lot about this, but it's a real thing. And not every person of color, not every woman of color, not every woman has imposter syndrome, but it is a real thing. How do you combat it? How do you recommend others combat it?
Yeah, you're right. Not everybody experiences that. And for me, I had a lot of imposter syndrome that I was dealing with. And I was just grateful to be in the room or at the table or being thought of for things. So I just didn't see my worth. And so I talk about having an empire state of mind versus an enemy state of mind. And an empire state of mind is that I can do anything. If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. But that enemy state of mind is steadily kind of just the self-deprecating mode that sometimes we get into. And that is half the reason. Like, yes, there's these external factors in the workplace that may prevent us from moving forward, but some of that is also embedded in who we see and who we want to be in the workplace. So I think it's important that we do that internal work to build from that.
Having a seat at the table is not only important for self-fulfillment, self-success, but studies have shown that it's also good for organizations in general. It helps organizations perform better. Talk a little bit about what you found regarding diversity in general, how it actually is a benefit to have more women of color at the table.
Right. So as you mentioned, there's so many statistics as to the benefit to the bottom line. And so I think the next phase of the conversation is the activation. You know, are we going to accelerate those who have been left out of the corner office? And I think it's really important for us to be a part of the conversation. And I think we're just at a very much a rhetoric phase of leadership, but the future of work will require the advancement of women of color.
There's also this other thing that we see. Many managers who are really on board with creating a more inclusive workspace, they're doing active work to hire women of color. But if you look at their organizational chart, all of the people of color, for instance, may be in entry-level or lower-level positions. How do you break through that? What message would you have for them? And what message do you have for folks who are working in those spaces, women of color, when they're looking around and they're seeing that there is an effort, but there is a ceiling at the same time?
That's a great question. And I feel as Black and brown women, sometimes there's what we call a Black ceiling. And what I found and what statistics have shown is Black women, we ascend to a certain point and then it tends to be middle management. And that's as far as many of us get. And I think that it goes back to two things, being either a cautious leader or a courageous leader. And I think cautious leaders will retain and advance women of color because it's important to be reflective of your mission and your values. So if you say that diversity matters, but no one in leadership looks like some of your workforce, then that signals to those women of color that you're not being intentional. And I think that people often say it's a pipeline issue, but it's really a retaining and advancing issue. And I think for women of color, oftentimes we have to also adhere to our expiration dates. Maybe we're at a company where we're never going to get to that table because of cautious leaders. And so don't be afraid to find a table that's right for you.
Minda Hartz, the author of The Memo, What Women of Color Need to Know to Secure a Seat at the Table. Thank you for joining us, Minda.
Thank you.
For more information on The Memo, go to hereandnow.org.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said today that his toolbox is limited to counter the effects of the president's trade war with China, a trade war that escalated again today. China says it's retaliating against the U.S. with a fresh round of tariffs on American goods worth $75 billion. Perhaps no surprise, markets are down sharply in response. Scott Horsley is NPR's chief economics correspondent. He's following this story. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Peter. Good to be with you.
And good to have you. At one point today, the market's down 2%. Investors worried about this escalation in the trade war and the Fed chair saying he can't do much to protect the economy from it. Did he explain why?
Well, I have to say, I think actually the markets are responding more to this extraordinary series of tweets we had from President Trump today. The markets certainly did go down a little bit this morning when China announced that it was going to levy tariffs on another $75 billion worth of U.S. exports, including automobiles. But they actually sort of leveled off after the remarks from Chairman Powell of the central bank, which were sort of very measured, stressing that the economy is in pretty good shape and that he and his colleagues are ready to step in if necessary to prop it up and extend this decade-old economic expansion. But that wasn't good enough for President Trump, who wanted some sort of promise of deep rate cuts. So the president came out with this extraordinary jab at the Federal Reserve chairman, asking rhetorically, who's the bigger enemy, Jerome Powell or the Chinese president?
That is remarkable, and, yeah.
And then, as if that were not enough, the president tweeted that American companies are hereby ordered to immediately start looking for an alternative to China. And that is when the Dow and the S&P really went over the edge, because
okay.
even for this president, that was a remarkable completely beyond the bounds of the actual presidential authority. Nowhere in the Constitution will you find that the president is the vice president of U.S. supply chains.
Okay. So we could dig into each one, but let's try to figure out why he's making these statements. We know he's had a troubled relationship with the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, who he nominated, by the way.
That's right. This is his handpicked chairman. And Powell has worked assiduously not to get into a back and forth with the president. He was careful today, as he always is, to say, look, it's not our job to second-guess trade policy. It's up to Congress and the president to set trade policy. We're just here to fulfill our mandate, which is trying to keep inflation in check and also maximize employment. And we're going to keep doing that. But the president wants the Federal Reserve to act as another arm of the executive branch and just follow his orders, and the Fed has guarded its independence and not kowtowed to the president in that way.
Well, and speaking of orders, you mentioned that, I mean, the president can't order U.S. companies to stop doing business in China, but he's asked them to anyways. Do you think they'll hear that message?
Not just asked them to. He has claimed to have some sort of power. And
right.
it'll be interesting to hear the critics here in Washington who like to rail against an imperial presidency or executive overreach. So far, we haven't heard much from Republican lawmakers about what has got to be the most traumatic example of would-be executive overreach I can recall from this president, completely beyond the bounds of any actual authority that he has. And this on the edge of the president about to head off to Europe for a meeting with the G7. So that should be an interesting weekend.
Scott, maybe it's a joke. I don't know. What do we make of this?
Well, the Wall Street's certainly not laughing.
Yeah. Scott Horsley, NPR chief economics correspondent. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Two Green Berets were killed in combat in Afghanistan on Wednesday, a reminder that the war there is not over. These deaths followed the horrific bombing at a wedding party in Kabul last weekend, claimed by ISIS, where 80 people died. President Trump has talked about withdrawing U.S. troops if a peace deal is reached with the Taliban. But a troop withdrawal could bring its own challenges, and history might provide some guidance. Keddie Davison, a retired Army colonel, served two tours in Afghanistan, and she's now director of innovation and tradecraft at the Institute for the Study of War. She joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You wrote an essay about the Soviet Union's withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1989 and the lessons the United States could and should take from that withdrawal. We'll have a link at hereandnow.org. But remind us why the Soviet Union was fighting there in the first place and why they pulled out.
The Soviet Union recognized that they actually had a national interest at stake, and they moved in to prop up a struggling communist regime. And after almost a decade of fighting, they came to the realization that the price they were paying, the cost, simply wasn't worth what they were getting out of it. And so they made a conscious decision to withdraw their forces.
And what happened when they withdrew their forces?
So they faced a number of challenges as they withdrew, and some of these are similar to the challenges that we might face. So one of the first things that happened is they put their forces on the defensive in order to prepare for the withdrawal. And so what this did is deny the Afghan security forces that they were working with the assistance of the Soviet forces that were on the ground with them. And this started to place stress on the Afghan security forces. You had other challenges as well, though. We had the Mujahideen that had been fighting the Soviet forces and their Afghan partners at the time. And external forces, such as the United States and Pakistan, continued to provide arms to the Mujahideen. So as the Soviets were preparing for withdrawal, they still were experiencing significant attacks from these well-armed Mujahideen. Mm-hmm. Now, as we consider our own withdrawal, we probably need to look at this lesson in history, because we can expect that Russia, perhaps with Iran and even Pakistan's support, might return the favor and continue to arm not just possibly the Taliban, but the 20-something constellation of extremist groups that operate in Afghanistan right now. So just as the Soviet forces had to fight their way out, we face the real possibility that we might have to as well.
Can you talk about that a little bit more? These groups like the Taliban or maybe the ISIS laying out the groundwork to take advantage of a possible withdrawal.
So right now what we have going on is a potential peace deal or a settlement between the U.S., the United States, and the Taliban. But there are significant actors that aren't included in these negotiations. So you have new forces that the Soviets did not have to contend with, such as al-Qaeda and even the Islamic State's Khorasan province. These groups that are not a party to the negotiations will have no reason to lay down their arms or abide to any ceasefire that the Taliban agreed to. You may also face the situation where hardline elements of the Taliban decide that peace isn't necessarily in their interest either, and they might actually move to some of these more extreme jihadist groups.
You mentioned the Soviets had to fight their way out, and if I hear you correctly, you say that that may be the case for the U.S. and NATO troops who might be leaving.
Yes. So not only did the Soviet forces have to fight their way out, they had to bring additional combat power into the country in order to secure the forces as they left. There is the chance that the United States and NATO forces might have to do the same, bring in different kinds of combat power to be able to protect the forces as they go on the defensive and prepare for the withdrawal.
And what would be the motives, the reasoning why this would happen? Is it that they want the United States to stay? Give us a little bit more understanding of that.
So the jihadist networks absolutely do not want the United States to stay. That's one of the reasons that they're fighting so hard, is they want to expel these occupying forces. But they also have no incentive to let the United States withdraw peacefully. In fact, you might even see a competition where these multiple jihadist groups try to make bigger and bigger attacks to be able to get a propaganda victory and claim credit for expelling the occupying forces.
Back to the lessons learned from the Soviet Union withdrawing, there's another issue you bring up in your essay that many of us don't think about, and that's the brain drain that happened when the Soviets pulled out back in the 90s. You believe the same thing could happen again. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. What we have right now are significant elements of the population that actually support the current government of Afghanistan. And so what the Soviets faced was sort of this pan-Afghan insurgency, where your Tajiks, Uzbeks, Hazaras, and Pashtuns came together to form these Mujahideen groups to fight these godless occupiers. We have a different situation right now in Afghanistan. The overwhelming majority of your Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, and most of your Pashtuns actually support the current government of Afghanistan and the national security forces that support that government. All of these different groups that have supported the current government and have been opposed to the Taliban and fighting them for almost two decades, it's hard to believe that they're going to simply step aside, allow the Taliban, who hasn't been defeated and also hasn't won a victory, to simply push them out of power and then stay in the country and provide their talents to the Taliban government. We're more likely to see a mass exodus of a lot of the educated civil servants that supported the current government that will probably have no role in the type of government that the Taliban envisions.
You write that the Soviet Union left behind a functioning central government and funding $300 million a month, while the U.S. and NATO may leave behind no government at all.
So what we have right now in Afghanistan is a national unity government that came out of a compromise from the last election that hasn't necessarily acted as a unified government. We have presidential elections scheduled in Afghanistan for next month. The peace talks, though, between the U.S. and the Taliban and the potential for some sort of interim government are actually calling into question whether or not this next presidential election is even going to go forward, and if it does, whether it will have sufficient participation to have the results be legitimate. So if you have a government right now that isn't necessarily unified, You have a potential government that's going to come out of elections if they occur, potentially not have legitimacy. You've got this nebulous idea of what an interim government might be, and a Taliban potential reintegration with people who have been opposing the Taliban for the last couple of decades. This does not lend a lot of confidence to an idea that you're going to have a unified and functioning central government in Afghanistan over the near term. The challenge that you have when you don't have a functioning central government is you also don't have an ability to be able to receive international funds and then use those funds to pay your Afghan security forces, who can then translate that funding into operational capability. Mm. And one more additional challenge, if you've built, as we did, a national security force, and the national government that that force is supposed to be loyal to is in question, then you can see how fragile the entire apparatus is.
Mm. You have decades of military experience. I'd love to know your personal thoughts as you watch all of this play out in Afghanistan right now.
So my heart goes out to the families of the fallen, and there is no way to make up for that loss. But Afghanistan is not an easy place to leave. Great powers go into Afghanistan because they have national interests at stake, and they find it hard to leave Afghanistan because of those national interests that are at stake. So this is not an easy decision to decide to withdraw or even to decide how to withdraw. So my thoughts are this is an extremely complicated and complex environment with no easy solutions, and we are paying a high price for our national interests right now.
Ketty Davison is a retired Army colonel. She's now Director of Innovation and Tradecraft at the Institute for the Study of War. We'll link you to her essay about the challenges of withdrawing from Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Colonel, for talking with us.
Thank you. It was great being here.
First, it was Flint, Michigan. Now, Newark, New Jersey is dealing with a huge lead problem. Residents there are drinking bottled water because elevated lead levels were detected in the city's drinking water. Lead contamination from a variety of sources has been an entrenched issue in cities for years. Many old homes were built before a lead paint ban went into effect in 1978. Officials are grappling with how to fix that problem. In the meantime, parents worry about the known health effects of lead on their children's brain development. But is it possible that the brain could compensate through the simple act of reading? Anne Glosser from WCPN IdeaStream has the story from Cleveland.
What's this?
Mouse.
Yeah. I see a nose on every face. I see noses every place.
About a year ago, at 1 year old, Eden Tobik was found to have a blood lead level of 19. Any amount of lead is harmful to young children. 5 is the threshold of concern. Her mother, Casey Tobik, was devastated.
Shock, guilt, shame, fear, despair, terror sets in, and then you Google it, and it gets even worse.
They didn't have chipping paint, just an old house in Lakewood with friction surfaces causing lead dust that Eden must have ingested as she crawled around like any normal toddler. They took out a loan to make their home lead safe and were told to give Eden healthy foods and a multivitamin. But other than that, doctors had nothing else to offer her.
It was very much a, this is it, let's just watch and wait and see what happens, which as a mom is like the worst thing you can hear from a medical professional because you just feel helpless.
If I have a child with lead poisoning in front of me, I would never say to the parent, it's hopeless.
That's MetroHealth pediatrician Dr. Robert Needleman.
We don't know in your individual case what that lead may or may not be doing. But what we do know is in every case, if you talk with your child and listen to your child and have conversations and read books together and learn together, your child will be smarter and have more self-control and behave better than if you don't do that.
The key is to remove the source of lead exposure and provide a nurturing environment where learning can happen. One-on-one conversations and interactions promote healthy, strong brain connections.
Those kinds of conversations cause the brain to grow in positive ways and essentially combat the negative effects of lead.
While the cellular damage of lead is permanent, Needleman and other experts say the young brain is highly resilient and they believe it can compensate for the loss.
If one part of it isn't working very well, other parts can take over. And also, it's growing. It's not finished.
Needleman says reading offers one of the best ways to help the brain bounce back from lead exposure, which is why he helped start the National Reach Out and Read program, where doctors give books to patients and encourage reading. Looking at pictures, naming objects, hearing, and sounding out words all fire up important connections in the brain. University of Cincinnati researcher Kim Dietrich was part of a 2015 CDC working group that reviewed the scientific literature on ways to help lead-exposed children.
The idea, the concept that children who are exposed to lead early on are a lost generation is completely fallacious.
Dietrich thinks reading is an excellent strategy for helping lead-exposed children, but he and others in the field, including Needleman, acknowledge that there isn't perfect scientific data on its effectiveness. And it wouldn't be ethical to do a perfect study. You couldn't ask some parents to not read to their lead-exposed children just so you'd have a control group. Case Western Reserve University's Rob Fisher is planning a new study to gather some data about programs that get books into the hands of children with lead exposure. Fisher recently co-authored a study that found that high-quality preschool, which would have, in theory, a lot of reading and one-on-one attention, didn't help lead-poisoned kids catch up to their peers. But there's nuance to their findings.
We see in the evidence that there are lead-exposed children who are on track at kindergarten and that are on track at third grade. What's allowing them to overcome that adversity? It's very possible that something like reading and parental engagement in the child's life is the success factor that allows that to happen.
And one thing more, suppose no nose, where would all our glasses sit? They'd fall off, just think of it. The end. Another one?
For Casey Tobik, reading is something she would have done anyway, but she's encouraged by the messages of resiliency.
I am in a much better place than I was. I've sought out medical professionals of varying degrees. Everyone at this point is reassuring me that we caught it early and that, you know, her system is resilient and she will most likely not have any long-term effects because we caught it early. We got rid of the lead in her environment quickly and her levels have gone down drastically.
And at last count, Eden's lead levels are down to 3.3, below the threshold of concern. For Here and Now, I'm Ann Glosser in Cleveland.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.